Please join me in extending a warm welcome to our special guest tonight, Larry, from the Monday Night Big Book Group in Bellflower, California.
Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Larry.
And I want to thank you guys for inviting me up here to be with you, and I want to thank Chris for being my host, and John, and a lot of the guys that I met, and it's just a great feeling to be in a good home group. I'm glad to be with you, and I'm glad to be out of my car, and I had a great plane ride up here and everything, and except for the car ride to the airport was kind of a little wild. I was running a little late, and I got into the car and speeding down the road, heading towards the airport, and a glove box plopped open. So I kind of speeded up a little and slammed it shut, and it plopped open again. So I speeded up a little more, brought it up slowly and locked it, and it plopped open again. So I speeded up a little more, turned the damn radio off, and slammed the thing and then locked it, and then it plopped open again. Now, the idea of leaving the damn thing alone never entered my mind. I'm going to work on that thing all the way to the damn airport, you know, and as I stand here tonight in Portland, my car is over at the airport, and the glove box is wide open. But I got a long ride home. And this time it's going to be different, you know. I just can't leave it alone. I don't know about surrender. I want to welcome the new people, and I hope you probably feel like you're in your final hour, you know, and we kind of hope you are. If you don't know, if you're an alcoholic, stop drinking. And if you get pissed off watching other people drink, welcome to AA. I mean, there's nobody more irritated about the way people drink than alkies, man. You know, they just don't do it right. They drive us nuts, for Christ's sakes. You know what I mean? And so if you're new, I really hope you're at that part where you're ready to enter a new way of life. You know? And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's more than not drinking, you see. It is for a guy like me, because not drinking's never been enough. You see, because I'm the type of alcoholic that drank because of the way that he felt when he was sober. You know, sobriety drove me to drink time and time and time again. I couldn't stand the way I felt when I was sober. And I'm surrounded by people, and I've got this thing in me that tells me that if I stop drinking, everything will be all right. You know, and there's the worst state of mind for an alcoholic to be is when he's not drinking. We have the type of disease that strikes us when we're sober. It just waits for us to stop drinking, you know. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, your best teachers are your eyes. Your eyes will teach you everything you need to know about staying sober and everything that you'll see that will get you drunk. Your eyes won't lie to you. And to the untrained eye, it looks like people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they stop drinking and they get a little job and they get a little apartment. Maybe they get a little person on their arm. Maybe they get a little used car. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And there could be nothing further from the truth. That is not the treatment for alcoholism. That stuff comes with just hard work and good fortune. Because what will happen is if you start coming for these things, you'll eventually get them. And then you'll be sitting in these meetings, and you won't be drinking, and you'll be restless, irritable, and discontented, and you won't be able to figure it out because everything about your life seems to be what you wanted, and you're still so hostile that you don't think you belong here, and you maybe think there's something wrong with you other than alcoholism, and you'll slide into a doctor's office, and he'll certainly tell you that you're depressed and maybe you need some anxiety or antidepressants, and you think that will be your cure for alcoholism, and then after a month with those, you'll be restless, irritable, and discontented, taking those things, and you'll come to around us, and you won't know what the God's wrong with you when you've missed the whole thing completely. The treatment for alcoholism isn't coming here and getting your life together. The treatment for alcoholism is coming here and applying this book to your life. Somewhere in this book, in the first paragraph of Working for Others, it says, practical experience teaches us that nothing will keep us immune from drinking. than intensive work where other alcoholics. And this will work when other activities fail. And if I ever forget that, I'm a dead man. Because my disease is the kind of disease that could care less that I'm in Portland. I got a head that's designed to get me loaded. It could care less I'm in AA. I got a busy head. I got a lively head. I don't need no steering committee. This thing's alive and well, you know. If I can get it down to four voices, I've got a good day, you know. And my head loves to chat. I've got a type of head that it doesn't care how physically tired I am, you know. I'll be out all day doing stuff, working and stuff, go to a meeting, come home at 2 o'clock. I'll be physically beat, and I'll lay my head down, and I'll hear this, hey, Larry. I know you're there somewhere, you know. Let's chat, you know. And I'll be tossing and turning, and it wants to talk about when I was a baby and bring me right up to date, you know. And the sad part of that is we just did that the night before, you know. It doesn't care, man, you know. So I've got this deadly disease that just waits for me to stop drinking. And it's like a piston in an engine, man. It just works on me. And sometimes I am so glad. That's why serenity to me is not so much that I can be in a car and be quiet or behave myself in a market. Serenity to me is to know where I'm supposed to be that night and who with. There is nothing more secure than if you're new than to know where you're supposed to go and who you're supposed to be with. And that's why a guy like me needs a home group and a string of meetings, because it plays hell in between meetings. But at least I can have one of those crazy alky days out there trying to be one of them for 8 hours. But I know that if I'm that goofy, I know that on Saturday night, I'm supposed to be at a meeting, man. And it gives me something to shoot for. There's a sense of security in this thing called structure. You damn Nazis, you know. And there is a sense of security for the alcoholic of my type when he knows that no matter how goofy he is, in about an hour, man, I'm going to be floating and there's going to be 200 goofs just like me. And at least I'll know where they're at. You know what I mean? And that is why I am in here tonight. It's not to get my life in order. It's to keep my little crazy head from telling me, man, this ain't the answer either. Because if you're new, the obsession to drink for a guy like me, and alcoholics of my type, the obsession to drink will never come back as a form of a drink. The obsession to drink comes back as a form of, I don't need to do this anymore. I've been doing this for 3 years. Let somebody else make coffee. You know, and the road to hell is paved with good intentions. People that get loaded in A, they're not out, they don't, you know, oh, I've had it with this group. A lot of them got good intentions, man. I want to get that scholarship going. I've got a wife and a kid, and I need to spend a little more time, and their intentions are good. And slowly but surely, man, that thing that they were looking for, that I got to have balance, is just hanging them in the garage. Balance to me is treating you the same way I treat people at home and at work. Being the same wherever I go. And for a psychotic, neurotic goof like me, if I can be the same wherever I go, that's a pretty good deal. If I can get that personality down where I'm treating everybody with a little bit of love and tolerance no matter where I go, maybe I'm kind of getting a chunk of this thing called AA, because I've got a great life today. And not because of what I've achieved materialistically, but the things that go on inside that alky's gut and head where they're not fighting each other anymore. That constant battle between the mind and the gut. Oh, just do what you feel. Oh, just go with your gut, you know. And they used to say that the longest trail is for the alcoholic was to the head to the heart. And I believe there's a little further trail from the head to the feet. I don't think it's about what you think. I think it's about what you do here. And this meeting is one of these type of meetings that we'll give you three things. If you're new, we're going to give you love. But a little more important than that, we're going to give you hope. But even more important than that, we're going to give you something to do. We're going to give you a way of life. And it's not about sitting in here and having somebody give you the magic phrase and sprinting a magic sentence or a magic wand and give you the key to life. Alcoholics Anonymous is about coming here and earning your keep here. Everything you do here, man, is you're putting a little bit of insurance here. And I'm a something-for-nothing guy. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a guy can stay sober for close to 23 years and not amount to a damn thing, you know. And I got, you know, I come from a great home and stuff like that. I was born in Detroit, and I come out to California when I was 4 years old. And you guys got great, Joe. And I come out, and I lived in a little foster home and stuff like that for a while. And Mom and Dad got together, and my mom was a great lady, still is, a little Scandinavian lady. And my mom loves speed. Any tweakers here? You know, she's the Bill W. of tweakers. You know, she was buzzing around that house, eating those diet pills, sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage all night, you know, and raking the neighbor's yard around 5 in the morning, you know, and she'd get her new prescription, and she'd get the power edger and do the whole yard, the whole block, man. She'd just take off, you know, and just a busy lady, you know, and always had that look of determination to, you know, and her favorite thing was she'd always be making Afghans, you know, day and night, man, just putting those babies out, man, and everything in the house had a fresh Afghan. The chairs had Afghans, couches had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodles, you know, and if there's any animals running around, they had a fresh vest on, you know. I had gloves and caps that I was hiding, you know. I mean, Jesus, you know. And she was just busy, you know, and the diet was working. Hell, she was down to a stick. She was just, you know, 50 pounds of eyes, you know, and of course, when you're a tweaker like that, she had a hobby, you know. She had a lot of hobbies, you know. You start one and you start going to the other one, you know, like that, you know. But on a good night, her favorite thing was to do jigsaw puzzles. She'd go down to Thrifty or Savon's and get her this 30 million piece jigsaw puzzle, you know, of the Sahara Desert, you know. I don't want to get any color in there, you know. It's going to be a long night and I don't want to have any trouble, you know. And she'd go down there, and while she was down there, she'd get a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had coupons on the back, and she would save the coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was in, you know. One that I know you know about, you know. And she'd come home and put on, she had one muumuu her entire life, and that damn thing was wearing thin, you know. And she'd come home and put that peroxide on her hair and plop open that card table, take two more Dexies and start putting together that puzzle. And she had a big pair of toenail clippers, because if she got a piece that wouldn't fit, well, she's snipping that son of a bitch down. You know, we got a job to do, goddammit, you know. And I don't got time for these pieces that don't fit, you know. And just a busy, and I'm growing up with these mom tales, you know. My mom, you know, don't go out and play in the gutter, you're going to get polio, for Christ's sake, you know. And the other one was burnt food is good for your gums, you know. You know, I'd be trying to sneak out, you know, around 6 in the morning and have this toast before you run out to school, you know. And it was burnt. You know, and I said, no, Mom, I don't want to. And I'd make a dart for the door. And she says, you come back here. She says, this burnt food is good to your gums, you know. And now she don't have a tooth in her head. God damn it, it's good for your gums, you know. And poor little thing, you know. But I love my mom to death. Make no mistake about that. No mistake. I was my mom's favorite son, or only one, you know. And I knew my problem when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous was because I was Mexican. And I took that fifth step and found out I'm a white man, you know. But my mom was a great lady and loved me to death. And I did with that lady what I would do to everybody that would ever show me any ounce of affection or attention. And I would play her like a fiddle up until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I would not spare her one moment of terror if I knew she had a buck. I played my mom up until I come here. Because I knew it would be my ace in the hole, you know. And she loved me to death, man. And as I stand here tonight, there is nothing more precious in my life than a man's relationship with his mother and father and his children. And that's what we're going to do, newcomers. We're bringing you back home. It's okay. You're coming back home, and you're going to start right here. Because there's nothing like that family, There's nothing like getting back with your mom, man, and getting in her graces and making those amends, and every ounce of peace you robbed from her, where every siren she hears and every newspaper and wondering if you're in jail again, you know that when your mom thinks about you, she ain't afraid no more. She got a little bit of peace now. Maybe now she can concentrate on her old life. What a neat thing to add to someone's life is a little bit of peace when they think about you. You know, and my dad's a refinery worker. My dad's a happy drunk. My dad's a World War II, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin singing the blues drunk, man. He's a refinery worker, and he loves to drink, and he loves to sneak into his own home, you know. And, he'd be up there on that gas meter around 3 o'clock in the morning. Open up, goddammit, you know, my dad loved to drink. He was a miserable man when he was sober, but he was a happy drunk, you know, and my dad used to tell me how good you got it. You don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, we really had it bad. And he did have it bad. He had a hell of a life, man. His father died, choked on his tongue when he was about 10. His mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And he brought up his kid brother doing little side jobs and stuff like that. And his dream was to go in the Navy, get my mom out of that convent. She was in a convent for 13 years. Marry her. And their dream was to come out to California after the war and live that good life. And I became the nightmare of that dream, you know. But my dad was my hero, man. I wanted to be like my dad, man. My dad is the kind of guy that everything he touched turned to gold. And he was a worker. I mean, he started off in Union Carbide, you know, and he started off as a janitor and stayed there long enough to become a plant manager. You know, he hung in, man. He knows how to hang in. And I was embarrassed with my folks, man. My mom worked at, she cleaned houses and worked at drugstores, and I was ashamed of her. My dad had lunch bucket and glasses, and I thought he looked weak, you know. And my dad, man, like I said, he used to drink and sneak through my bedroom window and work in graveyards. He's always coming home at different hours, you know. And he snuck in that room one night. I smelt that boot coming down on my chest like that, and I grabbed his boot as he's sneaking in again. I said, hey, I says, you know, why don't you have mom make you a set of keys, you know? My God, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. But, man, I looked at how my dad handled things, man, and I got the message. And the message that I got from my dad was, no matter how hard it gets, you figure it out, and you hang in, and you work it out, you know. You figure things out yourself. You hang in, and you work hard. These are going to be characteristics that would never enter my life, you know. Along with being an alcoholic, I got lazy ass running all the way through me, man. I'm a something-for-nothing guy, man. I come to alcohol, and I'm the type of alkie that has to be treated special just to feel average. I'm the type of guy who does average things expecting standing ovations. Yeah, I take out the trash, and I think my wife is in the kitchen going, oh, my God, isn't he wonderful, you know? I go to work, and I think the boss is in the office going, Jesus Christ, man, my God. They don't make them like that anymore, you know? You know, and I'm like that today, man. I put a toilet seat on. You know, always got to get that recognition for something you're supposed to be doing anyway, you know. I put a toilet seat on for my wife, and I waited 3 months for her to say something, you know. Every time she'd come home from that meeting, man, I'd be in that bedroom, Chris, going, come on, Rosie. Jesus Christ, what kind of sponsor do you have, man? Get out, you know. My God, that's a brand new piece of cherry wood you're sitting on in there, man, you know. Get out of yourself, man. Work a program, you know. What kind of sponsor do you have, man, you know? I had to tell her. I couldn't stand it, you know. Always got to have that recognition for stuff you're doing anyway, you know. And man, I wanted to be like my dad, but at around 11 years old, sobriety stopped working. I knew that there was something in me, man, that there were kids around me, and we didn't have a lot of dough, but it seemed like all the kids around me seemed to grasp and develop a manner of living, and they seemed to mature and just go along with life, and they knew what they were going to do, and I'm 11 years old, and it seems like the older I'm getting, the more afraid I'm getting, and I've got this fear going with me all the time, and I don't feel right. I had one dream. Bobby down the street had a dream, and he wanted to be a mechanic and an engineer, and little Ruth Ruthie down the street had a dream. She wanted to be a secretary. I had one dream from the time I was 11 till the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is one of these days, I'm going to feel and think and be normal. One of these days, man, I'm going to feel normal because there's something about me that ain't right. And I'm doing everything that everybody around me does, but there's a part in me that just ain't right, and I don't know what it is, you know? But I can't tell anybody about that. Go ahead and find out that I'm a drinker. Go ahead and find out that I'm a loser, man. But you know, don't know that I'm just this close to jumping off the cliff, man. And I'm restless and I'm irritable and I'm discontented. And I don't know what, and I'm always thinking, and I'm not talking about that, you know. And I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser. And when you're a loser like me, it seems like people are always bringing people to your side to compare you to, you know. My mom would bring over some people, and Larry, this is Bobby, you know, why don't you try to be like him, you know? And I remember being a freshman in high school, you know, and I'm in the principal's office for being drunk on campus, you know, and me and my dad are in the principal's office, and my dad sees the star quarterback up there on the principal's office, and he says, why don't you try to be like Coy, for Christ's sakes, Larry? He seems to be having his head in the right place. And he says, yeah, I guess. Next year, I'm in the principal's office for being loaded on barbiturates and being drunk, and I stole the janitor's cart, and I drove it through the library doors, you know, and me and my probation officer and my dad are sitting in the principal's office, and my probation officer says, hey, why don't you try to be like Coy? He seems to be having his head together, you know. My junior year in high school, my big sister starts dating some guy, and she brings him over, and it's Coy. It's old number 7 right there on my couch, you know, and... My mom comes over in her shiny moo-moo, and she says, honey, why don't you try to be like Coy, you know? My senior year, I'm going to do 90 days in the L.A. County Jail, and some guy slides a newspaper in that says, Coy makes all pro CIF, you know? And I said, shit, I'd like to be like Coy, you know? And what goes around comes around in old A&A town. I'm about 5 years sober, and I'm in downtown Los Angeles at a street light, and it seems like in L.A., it's vogue that on every street corner there's somebody selling peanuts or oranges, or they have this sign that says, I'll work for food, like you don't, you know, and Jesus, you know, and these guys are, people, I look like a guy that needs help. People are always putting pamphlets in my pocket, and they're telling me, you know, Jesus is coming back, and Noah's on his way back, and all, you know. You know, everybody wants to meet you. You need help. You know, I've got pamphlets all the time. You know, shit. You know, and so I pull up to this guy in a sign. You know, and he's standing there with that sign, and he makes eye contact with me. I go, shit. You know, I got $2, and he ain't getting it. You know, because I'm the cookie lady in my home group, and this guy makes a beeline to my van. I go, oh man. You know, I can't roll up the window because there's nothing in there. You know. And he sticks his head in the van, and he goes, Larry Thomas. And I go, Coy. You know, it's the star quarterback, you know. And I said, my God, you know. And then I thought, well, if there's any justice in AA, maybe my sponsor could write him a letter saying, hey, why can't you be like Larry, you know. But there I am, I'm 11 years old, and I'm restless, and I'm irritable, and I'm discontented, and I'm doing that thing that I always do, and that I always will do, and that is look around and compare. My God, if you're new, the worst thing you can do is compare. AA's like a nudist camp. Everything's okay until you start comparing, you know. You know. And I started doing that at 11 years old, man. And at 11 years old, there's 4 of us in a garage, and I start passing around a bottle of 4-Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, man, it shut off my head, shut off my gut, and for the first time in my life, I felt, man, this is it. This is the best thing that I've ever felt when I was sober. Felt better than any home run I ever hit, any D I ever got, any group of people I ever hung around. This is it. This was the thing. And I knew I had my key to life, man. Everybody else had their ace in the hole, and I just found mine. It was like I had a secret calculator at a math quiz. I knew it, man. I knew this, and I started leaning on this stuff, and it wasn't hard to get. Dad had it all around the house, and I just leaned towards that white port. and it was not hard to find. And I didn't head out to Skid Row the next day, but I did get the address, you know. My freshman year in high school, I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had her brothers. They love cars, and I love cars, you know. And I started hanging around these guys, and we started drinking that wine and eating those barbiturates and lowering our cars, you know, and we'd lower our Chevrolets. I'd get my hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, man, you know. I had these big hair, you know, and white T-shirts with black khaki pants that came up to here, you know. I had these big pointed shoes. Somewhere along the line, somebody told me that men who are well endowed had big feet, so I had a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know. I had big hair, big feet, big ideas, and we'd drive around and bouncing around, you know, and drinking that wine, wondering what the hell you're staring at, man, you know. Listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day, and the Four Tops came on, and I just start sinking in my damn truck. I loved it, man. I had a Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she curled her hair up real big, you know, and I'd get my hair up real big, you know, and we'd bounce around all night with our frowns on because our asses hurt, you know. And oh, yeah, man, you know. And when you're a sophomore, it's like they have a driver education class, you know, like you haven't driven yet, you know. And I'm always going to different schools, you know, so I'm always having to take summer school. And it's summer school, and it's my turn to drive, and you're always driving with the biggest football coach in the world, it seems like. I show up, and he says, all right, Thomas, get into the car. So I get my hair into the damn car, you know, and there's these three girls in the back seat, and they're a driver education class, too, and we start driving around, and coach says it's a pretty hot day. He says, why don't you drive up to the Jack in the Box over there on Torrance Boulevard, and I'm going to buy everybody some Pepsis. I said, what a cool coach. I drive up to the Jack in the Box, you know, and wheel in there like I know what I'm doing. Totally forgot that 15 minutes before class, I took four of what they then call Tylenols. And I'd just been drinking wine and minding my own business, doing a little bit of heroin, and some guy laid me out. I'd never taken them before. They're half second, all half. You're knocked out telling the truth is what you're doing. You know, every Al-Anon's dream, for Christ's sakes, you know. I forgot all about them. I pull up to the Jack in the Box, and boom, these things nail me, man. And I look over there, and now there's three coaches sitting there, and I can't see, but, you know, and I can't talk. I want to talk, you know, and it's coming out like, you know, and he's looking at me, and he goes, drive up and talk to the puppet. And I'm like, shit, I can't see the puppet, you know. I want to talk to the puppet, you know. I want to ask him to come out and be my designated driver, for Christ's sake, you know. I drive up to the menu, and I hear that little pissy kid, can I have your order, please, you know. And I want to talk to him, you know. And so I turn that big corner, and I hear this big crash, and I see this puppet's head's hanging down, you know. I ran over the puppet. The police come, and they throw me on the hood of the car, and they shatter my hair all over the damn parking lot. And I don't drive till I'm 30. Big deal, you know. Now you can drive shotgun all night, man. And there's nothing like driving shotgun. And let Rudy drive all night, man. You can sit over there and drive shotgun and drink that cheap wine, man, and look at that little rearview mirror and watch the magic take place, man. Watch a little loser turn from howdy doody into James Dean in two drinks, man. And you look at yourself in that mirror and you say, Jesus Christ, are you good looking? My God, what are you doing with these Mexicans? You ought to be an underwear model or something, you know? You don't wear any, but what the hell, man, you know? You got cigarette butts stuck in your hair, you know? You got a little bit of puke on your tank top, you know? And you feel foxy. You feel like dancing when you look like that, you know? I do. I'm ready to dance, you know? You know, and I loved it, man. I loved the way I ran into a kid like that not too long ago. I'm over there at some mall by our house about 3 years ago, and this kid comes walking by me. He's about 19 years old. He's all tatted down. He's got a bald head like a cue ball. You know, he shaved it, and he's got a tank top on. He's got his mom's earrings on. He's got a ring in his nose, and that's attached to his lip, and that's attached to a chain to his wallet. He's got a ball bearing in his mouth, and I walk by him, and he goes, what are you looking at? I said, I don't have a goddamn clue what I'm looking at. You know, I said, what am I looking at, you know? And now I sponsor the guy. He's down there in Laguna, you know. What do you want me to do? I says, well, why don't you unlock yourself, for Christ's sake, you know? What do you want me to do, for Christ's sake? Well, I don't know what's wrong with me. I come to these meetings and I feel so damn different. No shit. You got a cyclone fence for a hairdo, you know. you're chained in there like a tiger in heat, you know, and you wonder why you feel. How many other people do you see chained up like that, champ? You know what I mean? Well, what do you want me to do? I says, well, you know, let's start with the earrings and stuff. Start putting together your mom's jewelry and giving it back to her, you know. Now he's got these big holes in his ear, you know. So I think he put a 30-day chip in there. I'm not sure, you know. I don't care what he does with it. Could care less, man. Get a commitment, you know. Be a greeter. You're great to be a greeter. Hi, welcome to AA. Ching, 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 ching. You know what I mean? Just, sure enough, you're shaking hands with another son of a bitch that's dressed with chains. Hey, you know, you're in the right place, man. I swear to God. This is the thing that I was waiting for my entire life, where I don't have to live behind an image no more. And man, alkies are image livers, man. We've got, if it ain't the little loser or the dope fiend or the drunk or the intellectual or the scholar or the mechanic, we come to AA and sometimes we're the slipper. There's an image they hide behind. My case is different. I can't stay. I need a slipper sponsor, slipper meetings. You don't really understand, you know what I mean? And there's all kinds of things to hide behind. And I think one of the things you hear a lot when people are new, and you probably went through that phase, a couple of you, I know I did, is where you're here for a little while, and you hear that God, that's so familiar, I feel like such a phony. You know why? Because you feel like you're putting on another act. This is a whole new way of life, and you think it's another image. It's not. It's just feeling different until you fill up the coat. This is going to be a way of life. This isn't play. But you're so used to putting on jackets, you think you've got another jacket on here. And you don't. You're becoming yourself. And you've never wore that jacket before. And it's going to feel unfamiliar. And it's going to feel not the right size. But AA will start filling it up. And you'll become friends with the person that you've feared your whole life. And that would be yourself. There's nothing wrong with you. You're a person with a disease. A spiritual malady. Something that there's not a living condition in the world that'll help you. There's not an amount of money. There's not an amount of religion. There's not an amount there isn't a living condition that'll keep you sober. Because if there was, we'd be meeting there tonight. People in Alcoholics Anonymous have tried every imaginable remedy. We have tried every imaginable remedy, all at the beck and call of, this ain't working either. This ain't working either, man. This time it's going to be different. I'm going to pour me a shot of bourbon, and I know the circumstances, and I know the consequences, and I know what's going to happen to me. And I got chunks of liver in my pants, and I got little people praying for me. I'm even praying, and it don't work anymore. I'm hoping I can stop. And 2 months, 3 months go by, man, that god-awful alcoholism strikes you when you're sober, and I can't stand it, and I'm not drinking, and maybe this time it'll work like it did in 1965. Maybe this time I won't slip into a blackout. I'll just have a couple shots of PM bourbon. That's it. One more attempt and one more failure. Countless vain attempts. People like us don't come here because we've had a bad month. People don't come here because they're happy and well-adjusted. People come here because they know there's not another place in the world to go. And the god-awful thing that happens to us is we think that AA is a step down. We think it's a long arm of the Salvation Army, or it's a long arm of the courts. And that's why meetings like this are so important, because this is a meeting of enthusiasm. This is a meeting of class and character. This is a meeting that has respect for a thing called AA and the people in it. And if you're new, what's going to happen is you're going to find that this is really a step up. And your best idea you can do is to come in here, get to know somebody, to call a sponsor, because there's nothing finer than the relationship between a man and his sponsor or a woman and his sponsor. There's nothing finer than that relationship. Your whole life depends on that eye-to-eye contact. There's nothing neater than me and my sponsor riding in that car and telling him my secrets and him looking at me saying, me too, pal, but this is what we're going to do about it. That life of secrecy that kept us alone. The alky loneliness isn't that we can't fit around people. The alky loneliness that we suffer is no matter who we're around, they don't understand a damn thing we're talking about. Because one more time, we're trying to get understanding from normal people who we eventually wish to be like. But we never think about seeking identification with people like us. No one likes to admit he's an alcoholic. Because that means one thing. And that is the terror of our life, is we're going to have to stop drinking. When an alkie has to stop drinking, he just ain't giving up a bad drunk. He's given up the love of his life. He's given up every ounce of hope he ever had about being anybody. It's all I ever relied on, man. And you're telling me that if I give that up, you've got something that'll fill that void? And we do that, and it doesn't happen in 30 days, and we're frustrated. We do that, and the certain things don't happen within a year or so, and we're discouraged. That book constantly tells us, don't be discouraged. Because Bill knew what he was talking about. He knew we'd be waiting for the kaboomy. He knew we'd be sitting here wondering when we're going to get ours. Sitting in the middle of it, getting it every day, wondering when we're going to get it. You know, He knew. And I floated around with those guys for a long time, driving around those lowered Chevrolets, and I knew that one of these days, man, that me and Pooch and Loopy would bounce off into the sunset, man. I had a life that I loved. In 1969, all my buddies are going places. Some of them are going to Vietnam, and some of them are turning hippie and coming up to San Francisco, and I wonder what I'm going to do with my life. So me and my buddy got together, and we thought we'd go back to Detroit and find my roots. And we wound up in Phoenix. And I'm over there off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Motel. I'm on the fourth floor of the Apache. It's a $40 a month hotel. Everybody has a TV, and it's in the lobby. Everybody has a bathroom, and it's down the hall. And you sit and you drink, and you got a little room. You got a Murphy bed that folds down, and on one side's a sink, and on the other side's a window. And you drink and you dream and you die. And you look out that window going, one of these days, I'm going to have it together. One of these days, it ain't going to be like that. One of these days, I'm going to go out there and have a little job, and I'm going to have a little life, man. One of these days, it ain't going to be like this, man. One of these days, it's going to be okay, you know. And I don't know too many guys down there, and I'm the type of alcoholic that I like going to the bars because it's like Halloween. I know I'm going to be somebody that night, and it ain't going to be me, you know. I may be a lifeguard, I may be a race car driver, you know, but it ain't going to be me, and I'm going to meet other people who ain't going to be them either, you know what I mean? And I met a guy, and I've got the type of personality, it's weird, that I am so insecure that no matter who I'm drinking with, after about the fourth shot of whiskey, I start sounding like that guy just to feel a part of him. You know what I mean? I'm so insecure, you know, and I'll stand drinking with a guy from Tennessee, you know, and after that third Boilermaker, I'm going, well, how are you? You know, well, you know, when are we going to go down there and get some wheat, you know, or something, you know, and then the next day I'll be at a Japanese bar, you know, hi, Mr. Letty, hi, how are you, you know? I don't care, you know. As long as I ain't me, I'm all for it, you know. And I loved it, man. And I met a guy down there named Ernie, and Ernie's an idea man. And I don't know how we're going to make some money, Larry. And I said, great, because I'm running out of it, you know. I tried being a plumber for about 2 days, and it damn near killed me, you know. He says, you know, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds, and you're going to be a jockey. I said, okay, maybe I'm going to start working out and stuff like that, you know. And he says, what we're going to do, we're going to get you down in 95. You're going to take some of this. And he gave me a bag of crystal meth. And I, you know, hey, I never had that. I'm just minding my own business, drinking my whiskey and my Thunderbird wine and stuff, you know. And I never took this stuff. He says, no, what you're going to do is you take this stuff. I'll come back in 2 months and we'll go weigh you in and get our colors, you know. He's pretty positive I could do the job, you know. And a guy comes back in a week and I'm in the same doorway. I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any goddamn horse I've ever seen in my life, you know. And I can't leave my room. I'm in my room chasing flies, you know. And every now and then I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing these black and white flashes, and that's the sun going up and down, you know. And I don't want to come out, Ernie. I ain't coming out there, you know. Spend all days beating your eyes to the next room, you know. And he says, you couldn't have possibly taken all that, you know. And so we had to can that idea. So I went down the vault, and I got a job with another plumber, and I'm under, you know, and I got to repipe a house, and I don't know how to repipe. You know, I'm the type of guy that always lies on his application so I can get more money, you know. Applying as a journeyman plumber 15 years, you know, and I never torqued a wrench in my life, you know. I'm afraid of turds, you know, and, you know, and, you know, and, And so my first job is he sticks me underneath this house, and I got to repipe a house. You know, I want you to string out the copper, and when I'm gone, we'll hook it up. And I'm underneath the house, and I, you know, and there's these crawl holes, you know, and I go crawling up to the hole, and I look out, you know, and seeing the cars will go by, and I got a pint of Kessler's with me. And I go back underneath that house, and I'm going, man, I got it made. You know? Yeah, I got a pint of Kessler's. You know, I'm underneath the house getting paid by the hour. Every now and then I bang on a pipe, you know. I got this cat down here that's staring at me, you know. And I'm looking at him, you know. He's wondering what the hell I'm doing, you know. And I got, man, this is great. And I start drinking and, you know, and I'm gone, man. They you know, at the end of the day, they pull me out underneath the house, you know. And somewhere during the day, I popped up through the floor in the bedroom, and I stole all the ladies' jewelry, so I got pearls and shit all over me, you know, and they're pulling me out, you know, and so they canned me from that job, you know, and I go down in a couple days, and I get a job with another plumber, and I'm digging his ditch for about 20 minutes, and I find out that the guy's younger than me. That ain't happening. I don't dig a ditch for a younger guy. No. And so I'm just got this resentment going, man. It makes for a square ditch, that's for sure. You son of a bitch, you know. And so I took about 2 hours of that, you know, and I faked a knee injury, and they had to take me to the hospital, you know, and I get a prescription for Percodan. And me and Ernie go down to the bar, and we start drinking, you know, and then we meet these guys from Tucson, and these guys know some doctors in Nogales, and they start taking my prescriptions, and we start writing prescriptions and selling them. We start writing prescriptions for Seconal and Nembutal and Obitrol, and you name it all. We wrote it all, man. Yeah. Damn near took it all, too, you know. And you know, after about 9 months, they caught up with me. And, well, you know, when you're loaded on barbiturates and whiskey, there's no freeway chase, you know. There he goes, down the 210. Ain't none of that happening, you know. It's just a matter of the sheriff coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, well, there he is under there. You know, always butt naked. Leave it to that alky, you know. And so they convicted me and they put me away for a little bit. And I come out of there, Southern Arizona, after about 8 or 9 months. And they gave me a $75 voucher to come back to California to L.A. City Hall. So I take Continental Trailways back to L.A. City Hall. I register with the City Hall, and they give me a voucher for a hotel, and I start taking Anabuse. And in 1974, I meet up with my little sister, and they give me a hotel down there in Torrance. It's called the Greyhound Hotel. It's about $40 a month. Everybody has a TV, and it's in the lobby, you know. Everybody has a bathroom, and it's down the hall. I have a little Murphy bed that folds down. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. You know, and I meet up with my little sister. Oh, man, I got two sisters. And my little sister, I didn't know my sisters looked up to me. Had no idea that they were always trying to hook me up with girls and stuff like that. And had no idea. And my little sister, you know, has got the chance of a lifetime. She says, Larry, she says, me and Danny, her husband, she says, we need to go to Monterey, California. She says, I got a job to be a teacher up there. She says, we need to go look at a house. She says, we need you to watch the house for us. Please, can you house sit from Friday to Monday? She says, I can't pay you. She says, but you got all you can eat, all you know, and all you got to do is bring in the mail and walk the dog. I says, oh, Debbie, you guys go. Don't you worry about a thing. I wanted to get in her graces, man, you know. She knew how much I hurt my mom and stuff like that. And I said, don't you worry about it, Debbie. And she was so happy, and they took off for their little home, and you know, that they were going to see. And I was so proud of myself, you know, finally doing something good, you know. Friday went by, they took off, and everything was okay, you know. And Saturday morning, it turned the news on, and Muhammad Ali's having a fight that night. And I love watching Ali fight, man. I love watching him fight when I'm drinking wine and having Jiffy Pop, you know. But I know I can't have any wine, you know, because I'm on this Anabuse and stuff like that, you know. And I don't have any money anyway, you know. But I start thinking about, wait a minute, what am I worried about? I'm in a house. I don't have to go out on the streets. It's not like I'm going to wander the alleys or something like that. I got everything I need here. All I got to do is bring in the mail and walk the dog, man. And I start, you know, and I walk that dog for about an hour, man, you know, and walking him back and forth, you know. I checked the mail, and I found out I didn't have any money. Well, how am I going to get a quart of white port without any money? And I start looking through her house, and I start going through her drawers, and I can't find any dough, but I stumble into the den, and there's this glass sparkless bottle, and it's full of pennies. Well, I grab that thing, and I start shaking that thing out until I get $1.19, you know, and went down there and got me my white port and my Jiffy Pop, and I come back home to turn on Ali, and to cap that seal, man, the sound that's heard around the world, and that's the last thing I heard until Monday morning. One more time, they're dragging me out of that house. And her husband's just yelling at me and just dragging me out. You son of a... And I'm going by, and with my sober eyes, I go by a couch, and the saw slit like that. I go by a picture window, and it's busted. I go by a TV set, and it's busted. I go by a dog's cage, and it's wide open. And I go by my little sister, and she's sitting on the porch crying. How could you? Just for me to be picked up a couple more days after that in a little league field over there in El Segundo, California, stone cold sober. They found me 2 months later after that incident. I'm stone cold sober, and I'm in between hysterical and maniacal. And I am in, and I ain't talking, and I am like a frightened deer, man. There ain't nothing, and I am in a place that I've never been to in my life, and I haven't had a drink for 2 months. And they find me in this little league dugout over in El Segundo. And the police come and the paramedics come and they take me to the Harbor General Hospital where they diagnose that some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts and that maybe I need to go to a state hospital for 30 days to be observed. And they sent me to a state hospital in California for 11 months. I was totally observed. And I came out of that hospital and they told me that I wouldn't be able to survive unless I took antipsychotics and antidepressants. And they gave me my little bag of pills, and they were absolutely right. I was sold on it. And after 2 months, I ran out of Thorazine, and they found me over at Alvaro Street in downtown Los Angeles, a public drunk, a public nuisance, curled up in a corner of a gas station, frightened, alone. And they rolled me up, and they sent me up to Wayside. And Wayside, I was up there for about 50 days, and they put about 60 of us in a black and white bus, for that long ride back to Torrance, California jailhouse where I'm going to be sentenced and put away. And at 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm in a holding tank about this size. And they send me in a holding tank. And they keep me there until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm all by myself. I got my Vons bag and no hope. I'm sitting on a concrete floor wondering where they're going to send me now. Because they're always sending me somewhere. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm listening for the only thing that I can listen for. And it ain't a song, but it's keys. I'm hoping I hear keys coming down there. And I hear some keys coming down there, and the guy slides open the jail door. And standing at the doorway is a Scottish man with a patch. He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Son, my name is Alex." He says, "Come with me, you're going to AA. AA? Those are two initials I've never heard of before. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's an AA, you know? And who's the Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? And that man put me in his little 54 Chevy, powder blue Chevy. Beautiful thing about this man, one I hope I never forget, is that he wasn't attached to anything. He wasn't a part of the courts. He wasn't a part of the local church. He wasn't even a part of an H&I committee of A&A that does institutions. He had a yellow golf shirt with a penguin on it. He wasn't even supposed to be there. You know why he was there? He'd gotten the worst news of his life. His wife was just treated and sentenced to death with terminal cancer. And he didn't know what to do. He was absolutely out of his mind. But somewhere in this book he read that practical experience tells us that nothing will immune us from drinking than intensive work with others. He knew he needed a drunk and he knew where they were. And he came down there hoping that the judge would find one for him. And Alex stood at that jailhouse door and he said, "Come here, son, you're going to AA. And I'm ready for a long ride and maybe some lunch up north." And he took me for a 20-minute car ride. And it was the most beautiful car ride of my life because he told me all about you. He was your biggest cheerleader. And if you're new, he told me the one thing that I hope maybe you'll grab tonight. And the earmark of the alcoholic, whether he's drunk or sober, is we have the ability to feel different. No matter what group we're around and what we're doing, we always have that little thing about us that makes us feel different. And he looked over at that car and the passenger said, and he says, "Son, I know you feel different. I know you do, Larry." He says, but I want to tell you something, son. In Alcoholics Anonymous, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are. That nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted. That's just what the Al-Anons feel when they see you leave, you know? He says, Alcoholics Anonymous is designed for guys like you, Larry. He says, are you ready for a brand new way of life? He didn't say, are you ready to stop drinking? Are you ready for a brand new way of life? And there, my friends, was the key to my life today, though I didn't listen to it for several years after. It took me a couple years after I got sober to finally realize that I can't live the way I used to live and stay sober. I can't rip and run and steal and lie and cheat and come here and live a spiritual way of life. There's no middle of the road answer. And from 19, and the guy took me through a 6-mile drive, 50-minute drive to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. He drove up to this little Alano club in Torrance, and he introduced me to a little lady named Indian Jeannie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people, man. I said, my God, I just lift a group of people like this, you know. Everybody's got a nickname and a tattoo, you know, and Little Moose, she was from Louisiana. She came after me like a toilet paper commercial. She, you know, hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are, man. I said, I'm not it, you know. And then this transvestite come out of the card room, and he started circling me like a helicopter, you know. And after about his third time around, he landed. And he says, you know, I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting. I said, I don't think so, you know. Not for my first year anyway, you know. I got my pride, you know. And then I said, hell, that guy's got big feet, you know. I mean, mess around with that guy, you know. So I said, Mike, and then sure enough, man, I look around that room. I said, my God, if that's AA, I don't want any part of this. And if that's the effect of that blue book, I don't want to open that thing either. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, and 60 days and get drunk, and 90 days and get drunk. And the biggest lie that I've ever told myself, you know, if you're new, was that I was in AA. I never touched AA. Now, that don't make me a better member or a worse alkie. All that did was prove to me one important characteristic about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called change. That I've got to change. Because if I don't change, my sobriety date will. And I don't have the power to change. But I know I can't live and think the way I used to do. And I've got to tap into a group of people that are making that change possible. See, because I'm a creature. I'm a creature of habit. I do what I'm around. And if I'm around people who are active and busy in the program of alcoholism, I'll get thrown into that like a wash machine. But if I'm around a bunch of slackers who are telling me, hey, what are you doing? You don't got to go to those meetings every day, for Christ's sakes. I've been sober 2 years and I don't got a sponsor. I says, well, how long is my visitation with you in jail here, you know? I mean, you know, we become what we're around. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of alcohol. And every time I called you, somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous would come. And they were always clean and they were sharp. Thank God for our central offices. Thank God for that little guy named Alex that came and got me. You know what I remember about Alex, and I'll never forget, is that him not being attached to any long arm of religion or hospital or anything like that, he was a trusted servant. The very thing that we give you on your first day of sobriety. Now, I can't be trusted, and I don't trust anybody. And the first thing Alcoholics Anonymous plops onto me is that I'm a trusted servant. We are trusting you that you're going to carry this message for fun and for free. We are trusting you that you're going to take people to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and give just for the hell. We are trusting you. And sometimes today, I'm wondering how that's been violated. Sometimes today, I think about me and Chris were talking today. And I have a hunch sometimes that if we were to vote for the traditions in the United States today, I wondered if they would pass. Why is it that an active group like this is such a minority and it's controversial, yet other meetings that just resemble the Oprah show are the ideal thing. It's not that we want to try to keep people out. It's because of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous is for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's up to us to keep it AA. We are our only chance of survival. And if we don't keep AA pure, nobody else will. And wouldn't you know it, here we have a pure meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's being talked about like it's a bad thing. Something's turned around here. But in and out of alcohol, and every time I called AA, somebody would come and get me, and they were always clean and they were sharp, man, which is one of the finest things that I feel today. I don't think there's a better feeling than getting showered up and coming to see you. I love the way you look when I see you. I love the way you look when I see you. Anybody can come to meetings in their plumbing clothes. Anybody can come to meetings in... But when I see you making that extra effort, you show me that this thing is a little thing. It's a step up. Your respect shows in your actions, not how long you speak when you take a cake. I watch you like a hawk, and I'm betting you're right. And you people have never let me down. And every time I called AA, somebody would come and get me. And in 1980, there's a guy coming to get me. I'm over at the Don Hotel. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot, you know. Every now and then I get one right. Donald Duck. Yeah, I'm a smart man. You know? 10 o'clock in the morning and I hear this, Larry, it's Don. I go, my God, it's that guy from AA. I didn't even call him and he's coming over here, you know. Can I come in? And he opened up the door. Oh, Larry, he goes, what happened, kid? You had 15 days. You were going to be a janitor in the city of Lomita. There's some hope for you, Wally. You know? He says, what's going on, kid? And I took a shot off of that bourbon bottle, and I told Don, I says, I don't want what you got. I don't want what you have, and if I ever get that bad, I'll come and get it. Why don't you just get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do? The cry of this alcoholic for my entire life, and every alky's got a cry, and that was mine. Let me do what I want to do. It'll be a cold day in hell before I ever get a man a cup of coffee in an AA meeting. It'll be a cold day in hell before I set up a chair and get there early. And as I looked at that guy, the only answer to life I've ever had left that room, that bald-headed carpenter. And I couldn't get him out of my mind for 2 years. I couldn't get these people out of my mind. I mean, if you're new and you're coming in and out, you may leave us, but we'll never leave you. I mean, yeah, because somewhere, somehow, you're going to be in your little car and you're going to cap the seal off your Smirnoff and you're going to think about that goof with the tie on in Portland, or you're going to think about the chip lady or the leader or something, but the seed's been planted, and the secret is that it's only planted in alkies, and I couldn't get this guy out of my mind, man, you know. And on May 2nd, 1982, I down there at the Woolworth store, and I'm checking into the mission. I got a hot plate and a hot TV, and I'm checking into the mission. I got my long hair and my street mud on, and I go by this Woolworth window, and I check eyes with the thing. And the thing's 120 pounds, and he's yellow. He's got his shoes tied to his pants. He's got his wine bottle in his back pocket, and I catch eyes with something. See, I haven't been looking at myself for a long time. I open up medicine chests. I don't look at people in the eyes. I don't look at myself, reflections, anything like that. And I finally lock eyes with myself. And I said, whatever happened to my dreams? Whatever happened to that kid that could run like a deer, had opportunities to model ties and do all these things? And so whatever happened to that guy? And I did what I always do when I get that way. I panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I called up the central office. And who do I get? I get Don. I said, Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the mission down here. I'm ready to come to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your little rusty ass down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. And I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love? You know, I just heard it, you know. And I took the longest walk of my life from Wilmington to Torrance, about 10 miles. And I waddled up to this club with my poopy pants and no hope. I knocked on the door and they said, what do you want? And I said, if it interests you, I'm looking for Don. They said, he's over there at the coffee bar. And I waddled up to that man and I asked a man that I never asked somebody in AA before in all those years. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds. And then he lit into me for about 20 minutes, you know. And he told me under no certain terms is he going to put up with my nonsense. And the guy became my first sponsor. And I shook it out with the drunks, and I hallucinated with the drunks. And I heard that music for about 3 months with the drunks, and I had DTs and convulsions with the drunks. And I stood around that Alano Club, and I waited for that Thursday night meeting as they were giving me honey and orange juice. And one more time, these people looked at me, and one more time, I stood up, and they held me up. And I stood up, and I said, my name is Larry Thomas, I'm an alcoholic. And for the first time in my life, I felt like a member, and I didn't feel like a guest. Because you were selling sobriety, and that's all I wanted. That I was going to take this thing, no matter what I was going to do as a way of life, whether I'd be a plumber or a produce man, no matter what it was, did not concern me anymore. What concerned me is that I stayed in your hip pocket because I knew that I was an alcoholic. Now, what does that mean to you if you're new? I'm an alcoholic. That means I can't drink. I'm an alcoholic. That means I shouldn't drink. Not to me. I'm an alcoholic. I know damn well I'm going to drink. I know that for sure, that the only thing that keeps me from me and drinking is you. There is no play about that. I know that I am capable of drinking. 23 years isn't enough. I know that I've got a disease that's just waiting for me to get complacent, just waiting for me to rest on my laurels and just snatch me. I've got a deadly disease, and I've got to treat this thing because it strikes me when I'm sober. And how did I ever know that living the best way of life would be its treatment? And I followed that man, and that man was my sponsor for a year and a half. And I loved him good, and I love him today. But after a year and a half, I started judging my sponsor. I started judging how he was living. I started doing secrets. I started knowing where all the meetings were and all the chips were and how to secretly work an honest program dishonestly. I know how to put on that AA face where an hour and a half they put on an AA face and a half hour after meeting time you go home and you die and you try to live those two lives because you can't give up to your old ideas. You're in here trying to learn a new way of life, but you're starting to get other obsessions and you don't know what to do with those things and they hound you all day and you think by feeding into them they're going to be all right. And what happens is after a year and a half, I started backing away from the sponsor. And I started judging the sponsor. And at 2 years sober, I'm in a club. And I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. And I'm thinking about what day it's going to be when I blow my brains out. And I'm absolutely in the middle of AA, but I'm not applying this book to my life anymore. Oh, sure, I did it with that first sponsor and went through it. But somewhere along the line, I started getting self-involved. One more time, I'm thinking about getting a normal life together. And at 2 years sober, there's a man that came down to that club and he told me what I was. He says, you're an AA pimp. You're a user of people. You're a taker. He said, there's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, son. He says, I sure hope you find it. And I followed that man. I followed that man to what is now my home group. I'd never had a home group before. I never had a sponsor like this. And he got me involved in the most beautiful thing in my life, and it's called my home group. That's my home. That's my home. And I do chores in my home, just like it was my personal house. If you were to come to my personal house, when it comes time to leave, I wouldn't say, would you help me clean the bathroom? It's my home group, so I have chores in my home group. And I'm the coffee maker, coffee pot cleaner for 20 years in my home group. And in that group, I come and I try to do the best thing that I can do, and that is recreate the atmosphere that was created for me. Because it's the only atmosphere that ever worked, and it's my job, my responsibility, I think, to recreate that atmosphere so that one day when there's another little clown or another little gal cumbling in, she'll come into that home group and it'll be as lively as it was the day I found it, and they'll say, maybe I can do it here. It seems to be a little bit different here. These people are happy and they're lively and there's electricity here and there seems to be some love and there seems to be some hope and there seems to be a lot of action. And this is where people like us survive. And I have survived in my... Because I'm the type of guy the book talks about. I don't know nothing about God. But somewhere in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about a guy that comes to AA, the bewildered one, who watches this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and before his very eyes, he is introduced to his God. I don't have to go searching for God. All I found him was on the end of a mop. And I became part of that power. I become a working part of that power. And that power today I choose to call God, and I find it in my home group. And the closest thing I know to God's will is the principles that are outlined in this book. I think as long as I adhere to that, I think my God is pleased with that. Because I am sure pleased with his kids. Because everywhere I go, all across this country, I keep running into his kids. And I'm not telling them anything different. And these kids like me seem to be listening for something. They're not listening for a different answer. People like you and me are listening for the answer that we're on the right track. And I'm here to tell you, you are. This group is on the right track. There's an identification that happens when I bring my spark and I hook up with your spark. There's an identification that's unshakable. Miracles seem to happen within that spark. Great events seem to come and pass for countless others. People like me and you take that inventory and we start getting it back together with our mother and father. That mother that I used to sneak in, she hadn't seen me for a couple years, and I sneak in into her house, and she's alone, and she's on the couch, and she sees me sneak in with my drunken mud, and she puts my head on her lap, and she starts crying and rocking me to this Michigan God, please help my baby boy. And I can feel her tears hitting me. And as they hit me, I say, Mom, it ain't that bad. It ain't that bad, Mom. Just to get up and start looking around for a bottle of whiskey. And I can't find it in her room, so I tear open the kitchen and I tear open the bathroom, and my mom comes down the hallway and she says, honey, what's wrong? And I start beating up my mom till I get blood out of her nose, demanding that she come up with a bottle, only for me to find it in the trash can that I'd already drank it. Getting together with that mom who hadn't seen me for a while, and the only thought that I have is she's maybe 50 yards away from me, I'm standing in my mud and she hadn't seen me. And I make eye contact, and she's working at a dry cleaner's. And the only thought that I have is she better have a dollar. And you take that same man, and you sober him up. And you put a secretary of a meeting that same distance. How come I can't ask him for a commitment? How come I can't walk that same distance and ask that guy for a commitment in a meeting? But I can take that same distance and walk over and beat the hell out of my mom's emotions one more time. That's what had to be changed in a guy like me. Somewhere along the line, I had to cross that invisible line my sponsor talks about from being a taker to a giver. That AA isn't about coming here and getting. That it's a coming up to a place and start giving just for the hell of giving. Even when you think you ain't got nothing to give, give a little more. And if you don't hear what you need to hear in your meetings, how come you ain't talking about it? Or are you waiting for somebody else on medication to say it? You need to hear about sponsorship. You talk about sponsorship. You need to hear about the third step. You talk about the third step. Don't wait for other people to do your work. You carry that message. And my mom laid in that hospital bed maybe about 4 months ago. And she's in this hospital bed and she's got to have her hernias removed. And I'm scared to death. And I go to my sponsor and he goes, just go over there and encourage her that everything's going to be all right, Larry. And I go up to that hospital and I encourage my mom. I tell her everything's going to be all right. I says, this operation is so easy that it's like getting your tonsils out, Mom. That you'll be up and moving around in a day. And she went and had that operation about 3 or 4 months ago. And it went south. They found more hernias and they found more ulcers and they had to go deeper. And I come up there with my little $7 flower to visit my mom and she's laid out. And she's got hoses going through her, and the nurse is standing at the door, and she says, are you her son? And I said, yes, I am. She says, she's been wanting to see you. And I walk into that room, and my mom's laying down, and she sees me out of the corner of her eyes, and she goes, and I kneel down to my sweet mom, and she goes, tonsils my ass. But on the way over there, I talked to my wife, and she goes, Larry, just go over there and soothe her and touch her. Women like to be touched. And I went over there, and I was afraid. And I remembered how when I was a kid, how my mom used to take me out of the gutter and massage my elbows with Cornhuskers lotion. And on the way up there, I remembered that her favorite fragrance was lavender. And on the way up there, I didn't buy a bunch of candy and stuff, but I bought me a bottle of lavender cream. And I walked up to my mom's room, and I looked at her, and she was laying there, and I said, Mom, I says, would you like your feet massaged? And her feet broke out of the blanket. They start humming, man. And we sat there talking, and I started massaging my mom's feet. And I'd never touched that lady in the 50 years that I've been alive. Not like that. And I massaged my mom's feet, and we laughed. And she's peaceful, and she's fine today. And she's a blessing in my life. She don't have to worry no more as long as I'm with you. And that father that I wasn't supposed to be, the man I hated my entire life was that old man. And the men of Alcoholics Anonymous, at the end of every meeting, we would stand and pray, and we'd do the Lord's Prayer. And because I touch men's hands at the end of meetings, and because I shake men's hands, because I look men in the eye when I shake their hands, there's nothing more annoying than shaking somebody's hands and they're in the other room. Look them in the eye. These are your people. And the men in Alcoholics Anonymous, by talking to a sponsor, I'm able to conversation with my dad, who become my best friend. In the last 2 years of his life, I got to go over to his house and clean him and wash him and take care of his checks while he's dying of his liver cancer. And I'd go over there, and my dad used to love to sing Bobby Darin, Mack the Knife. And we'd go over there, and every Thursday we'd have chili and stuff. Finest relationship I ever had was with that father. Everything I ever wanted to say to him. You see, when I drive around those nights and everybody would go to the clubs and I'm thinking I'm a hot shot in that lowered Chevy, you know what I would do? Eventually I'd break away from my gang and I'd find a bar down there where people twice my age were hanging out with. And I'd go in there and I'd saddle up to a guy my dad's age. And I'd talk to him about the things I wanted to talk to my dad about. I was no barroom dancer. I wasn't no disco man. I'd look for ladies twice my age and talk to them like I wished I could talk to my mom and have these conversations with. And when my dad passed away, I didn't know what to do. I was so frightened. And I went to my meeting, and me and my sponsor were talking, and we went to a retreat together. And on the way back, me and my sponsor were driving from Bakersfield. And all of a sudden, he put in a tape. And we started singing Bobby Darin songs. I never told my sponsor about that. And I'm looking over there, and my sponsor starts singing Bobby Darin. And every Thursday we have chili. And every void that I've ever had has been replaced. Everything you need to make you happy will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that hinders that happiness will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Your search is over, Wally. You don't have to go anywhere anymore, son. You're in the right place. There was a daughter that I wasn't supposed to see, my little baby Lauren, and she would hop up in my arms, and I'm 10 years sober, and I can't hold a job. You know why I can't hold a job? Because I have a resentment, and that resentment's with my first wife. And that resentment is, she isn't going to get a penny. And you know how you make that true? You stay poor at her. And you don't do well. And you don't stay on the job, and you get fired, and you, when you go visit your little girl, she hops up in your arms, and she's got holy underwear, and she's got holy socks, and she looks at you with those big Cuban eyes, and she says, Daddy, if you love me, why do you dress me this way? Oh, but you're right. You're right. And then the men of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to hold a job after 10 years sober. Now, what are you going to do with a guy like me? The men in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be a plumber. They took me out of the gutter and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sakes. And in May, my little girl's going to graduate from high school, my baby Lauren. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me that if I can go to Portland and talk, that I can drive to Phoenix and visit my daughter. And that I'm supposed to write her and never let her wonder where her father is. I may not be somebody's husband, but I'll always be somebody's father. Never let that little girl wonder where you're at. And she doesn't. And she called me up not too long ago and said, Daddy, the kids at school are making fun of me because I'm so smart. She said, did that ever happen to you? And like any good member of AA, I said, hell yes. We got a good life today, you guys. We've got a fantastic life today. I've got a beautiful wife that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where the women come. This is where they are. You're going to find the finest ladies in the world right here. and I'm 7 years sober, and I'm talking at a meeting in Downey, and I lock eyes with a Nicaraguan lady, and I couldn't keep my eyes off her. And at the end of that meeting, me and her are talking, and she says, "Do you love to backpack?" And I says, "I love it." I haven't backpacked in my entire life, man. But I'll do anything to get in the tent, that's for damn sure. And me and my wife have been together. We're going to celebrate 7 years of marriage in May. And I know she loves me because she doesn't need me for anything. She's a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. She has her own job. She sponsors people. She has her car. She doesn't need me for nothing. And she still likes being around me. And more important than that, I know why I love her. She's the first woman that I've told other women about. And one of these days, you bet your bottom dollar, I'll work hard enough, and I'll take her back to Nicaragua, and I want her to bring me to the shed where she was born, so that maybe by the grace of this loving God, I can kneel down and kiss the very ground she walked. Because there's nothing finer than love in Alcoholics Anonymous and knowing that you've been right while you've been away from her. I don't ever want to put a smile on that lady, make her frown on that smile. I want to look over there, and when she's sleeping, know that she's got peace with me. And the men of Alcoholics Anonymous teach me how to do that. I used to see people up at this box say that by the grace of God, they were sober. And I wondered how I could do that. And I didn't know what that meant. So I looked it up. And the grace of God means compassion for the suffering. The compassion you had for me when I was new. But it wasn't until I started showing that compassion for that new man that I can proudly say that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober by the grace of God. And that I hope that I never get spoiled by my great blessings, because I see people come here and they tell me how blessed they are. And they're blessed with their job and they're blessed with their new education. And then I see them hang themselves with their great blessings. I hope that never happens to me. I hope I'm always in your midst. Because when I'm around you, I know I'm in the right place. So if you're new and you feel like you're in your final hour, I have a hunch from where I stand. I think you're in your finest hour. Thanks, you guys.